Okay, well, this week's podcast, we're going to take on a little bit different subject matter and a takeoff of our last podcast. We're going to be discussing return to play, kind of the idea of, you know, what are the rules of exercises and which exercises might we use or not use to get the athlete back onto the field. So there's some physical, kind of some talk in the physical therapy world that may be shaky or doesn't hold water under scrutiny, and we'd like to discuss that yesterday. And today we have Jeff Moyer with us from Dynamic Correspondence. And Igor, I'd like for you to introduce yourself from Central Methodist University.
My name is Igor Mišević. I originally hail from Croatia. I've done my undergraduate studies at Virginia Tech, where I was also a thrower, and now I coach the throwers at Central Methodist University while I complete my master's degree.
Thank you very much for pronouncing the name properly, because I was definitely going to screw that one up. So thank you and welcome. We're really glad to have you this week. This will be a first time for Igor joining us, and he has a unique experience as well, being a track coach, being a graduate student, and also having an international, origin has a different perspective than maybe what would be typical in the United States. So with what we just mentioned, Jeff, you have way more experience in this area than I do, and you have a much better knowledge of what goes on. So I'm going to let you just lead the way here, Doc. We'll be able to answer all the questions, obviously, with no problem, and you're going to be able to frame better questions than I would. So take it away, Jeff.
Sure. Doc, today, you know, one of the things that's becoming ever-growing in sports training and athletics, especially youth athletics, is injuries. Physical therapy, is a profession that will never not have clients and not be busy. But with that, there seems to be some confusion and some issues with the role of return to play. You know, when is an athlete cleared? When, you know, when are they eligible or able to go back to playing their sport? The mindset seems to be as soon as the athlete is pain-free, they just want to jump right back into the sport without a full evaluation. A lot of times, they won't even finish their physical therapy sessions. They will just go right back to the sport and, not finish out with that. So, Doc, I kind of wanted to get your thoughts as far as, your idea of how return to play protocol should be. We can go any number of sports that you'd like, but kind of just wanted to get your general thoughts on that first before we get specific.
Okay, I can give you a little idea of what I used to do all the time when an athlete would come to me, just from a legal perspective, and I think we always have to look at this. Make sure that the athlete has been given the green light to play again. And this typically comes from not only just a physical therapist, but also from the doctors. Because the physical therapist should be working hand-in-hand with the doctor. Now, we give the doctors more credit than we should in terms of being experts in the area of, what's involved in sports and when an athlete should play or not play. That's another ballgame here. Between the two, once the athlete is given the green light, then they typically, as you mentioned, they go right back into playing. And this, to me, is wrong, depending upon the injury, of course. If it's minor, then I see no problem with it. But typically, if it's a major injury that keeps the athlete out for two or three weeks or more, then there has to be some lead-up to get him ready to play again. And this encounters several factors. Most important, what created the injury in the first place? We have to find out. And injuries, as we know, have a neuromuscular base. There was some miscommunication or miscue between the nervous system and the muscular system. So something happened, the athlete's coordination, if you want, or anything related to this, that caused the injury. And perhaps it was the lack of enough development of the physical qualities to withstand the stresses, or he was just doing it incorrectly with poor technique. So I always want to find out what caused the injury. So I had to look at their technique right away. And if I see a flaw in the technique, then I know, all right, that's what was causing the injury, if it's related. So we have to correct the injury or correct the flaw in order to prevent the injury. And then develop the physical abilities that are specific to the technique that he's using, or that's going to be, that he's going to be using if we change it. So these are the factors that have to be looked at. But if you go right back into play, they're going to be injured again. So that's just a general idea. We can go into more details as we get into specifics. So I'll leave it there.
Yes, sir. Now, with that, the role of physical therapy is to just get the athlete back to a functional level and pain-free. Mostly, they just address the site of the injury without looking at, and this is general, but they without looking at the whole picture. For example, I worked at a physical therapy, sports medicine physical therapy practice, and a lot of times, for let's say baseball players, for throwing athletes who come in with shoulder pain or elbow pain, they will do various rehab exercises with bands, external rotation, internal rotation, open cans, all the rhythmic stabilizations, and they have, for some reason, when it comes to exercise selection with physical therapists, and again, I'm just being general here, Doc, a lot of them are against doing any kind of overhead exercises for athletes, particularly overhead throwing athletes, because of whatever reasons that they have. I was curious towards your thought, why, if overhead throwing athletes shouldn't, why not go overhead with weights and doing other various weighted exercises?
All right. Quite a bit there. But let's take a look at physical therapy per se. I believe in my experience with physical therapists, they don't have qualifications to really work with athletes. And this is true of many doctors. Now, I know I'm saying a lot, and people can jump all over me. But I think I know a little bit of which I speak. I was one of the first people in the United States to teach a bunch of doctors when they first started the specialization of sports medicine. And like, for example, do you know what it takes to be a sports medicine doctor in this country? The only real qualification is to work with an athlete. So you may laugh at that, say, no, it can't be. But it's true. And only now they have some, specialized courses. And even there, they're so general. Like, for example, in the class that I taught, doctors didn't even know the difference between isometric, eccentric, and concentric contraction. But how can we talk anything about training or technique when they don't even know the basics of muscle function for the most part? So, I'm going a little off track there, but I want to give you a little bit of a background. The same thing with physical therapists. They're used to working with the general public. The general public is not the athletic market. The general public does not experience the stresses that an athlete experiences. They don't go through the same techniques. They don't do the same activities. So, your physical therapist and your doctor really don't have the experience to recognize what's going on with an athlete, what's happening to them, and more importantly, what should be done. So they come up with these generalities of don't do this, like don't raise your arms overhead. Well, it may apply to a large group of people, usually sedentary. But athletes must raise their arms over their heads. You can't have a volleyball player who doesn't execute actions with his arms over his head. A football receiver has to get his arms over his head. A baseball player has to raise his arms over his head to catch a ball. So we see these examples, and they seem elementary. But so how can somebody say, now, don't do anything with your arms over your head, when if you look at what the athlete does, they're raising their arms over their head. So it's idiotic to even hear the expression or having some physical therapist say, don't do this. See, it just shows that they're only used to dealing with the general public, not with an athlete and what he has to do. So if an athlete has to do these things, how can we prepare him to do these things and keep him safe? Nobody's looking at this. And that's where I severely criticize, you know, the medical profession, which includes the physical therapists. Okay, I might be going a little off topic there.
No, it's great. Now, with that, you mentioned earlier that, you know, when you were assessing an athlete, you look at their mechanics. Physical therapists tend to have their own various screenings, doing Thomas tests and Faber tests and functional movement screens and, you know, different kinds of movement screens. I was curious to your thoughts on if this has a place with athletes for assessments on return to play.
No, I think it's even idiotic to consider them because, again, these are great for an average person, maybe has particular problems, so let's see what's wrong with them, and so on. But for an athlete, we have to look at the athlete dynamically in performance of this activity. He's a bona fide athlete. Now, what is he doing in his performance that may be leading to injury? See, this is what they think. Well, if he, let's say, one foot is turned in a little bit and the other foot isn't, so therefore that's probably the reason why he's going to have an injury. Well, but there's no substantiation for it. In other words, they have not shown that these are the things that are going to lead to injury. They assume that they will. But one thing they leave out all the time, like I mentioned that thing with the one foot turned in and the other one not turned in, all athletes are asymmetrical. You know, there are going to be deviations from the left leg to the right leg. But yet they try and make both legs equal. And we shouldn't be doing this. Or both arms should be equal. Well, let's see, one arm is just slightly longer than the other arm. We're going to have to do something. You know, or one leg is a little shorter than the other leg. We're going to have to put a heel, a lift in your heel. Well, why? If you're not having any problems. See, we're trying to balance everything to keep it equal. And we shouldn't be doing this. So I think physical therapy with a lot of these screens, or even other people who use them, are not looking at what it takes to be an athlete. They're looking at the public and they're using the information for the public to an athlete. And this should be done. That's where the hang-up is. So it's one of my biggest peeves.
Yes, sir. Now, when it comes to, from my experience with physical therapists and working in an orthopedic practice, I'm fairly confident to say that physical therapists in school, when they're going through schooling, generally are not taught about exercise selection, intensity, volumes, and so on and so forth. So they generally just follow the 3 sets of 10 model without much rhyme or reason to it, other than that's just the way it's done, almost similar to a bodybuilding program. I was curious to what type of programming considerations as far as volumes, intensities, would you recommend, you know, during a physical therapy or post-physical therapy in a return to play?
All right, here, let me bring up a good point that amplifies what I said about how they don't have any background to deal with athletes. See, their training ignores the athlete. See, it's the same thing with the doctors. We're not looking at athletic performance. And if I can digress just for a minute, as I bring out in my Secrets of Russian Sports Fitness and Training book, Russian doctors, when they were in their heyday, they had to attend the physical culture institutes and learn about the technique that was involved in a particular sport that they were going to be a doctor for. See, the doctors were specialized for every sport. He was a doctor that specialized in volleyball. He was a doctor that specialized in track and field and so on. So they had to learn about the technique and the training, what the athlete had to undergo in order to become good. See, so I bring out this contrast, what you were saying, how they just use a protocol for bodybuilders. See, they're not looking at what athletes are presently doing today in their training. They're not examining the training of, let's say, a high-level athlete or a low-level or intermediate athlete. They're just going on standard procedures. And once again, for the general public. Of course, you know, your bodybuilding routine, we can say, is for the general public. Because many in a gym are looking for bodybuilding. This is what they do. So again, in general, it's not specific to the sport. We have to look at athletes and what they do. Okay.
No, that's great. And then I'm curious, because you're a big advocate of talking about specialized exercises, I was curious to your thoughts if there's a place in physical therapy, rehabilitation, or the return to play protocol for specialized exercises.
Oh, specialized exercises are the key to rehabilitation. Because if you want an athlete to get ready for his performance, let's say he had look at the baseball pitcher. All right, he had an injury in the shoulder. All right, maybe it was due to the technique, or let's say the elbow. Now, we have to take a look at how he released the ball. What is the elbow undergoing? Is the elbow extending at the right time? Should it extend? Should it keep that angle in the elbow? What kind of a pitch was he throwing? Was it a sinker or was it a curveball? Each of these has a different release. So we have to know what the actions were, how well he can perform each of these actions, and then create a specialized strength exercise that duplicates the same joint action in the elbow and or shoulder that duplicates what happens when throwing, let's say, a curveball or a sinker or a fastball. Whatever pitch he's throwing. We then have to have an exercise that duplicates what the elbow should be doing at that time. So this should be the crux of the training by a physical therapist in getting that athlete ready to play again. If they're just doing general exercises, well, I did biceps curls, I did triceps extensions, I'll have a strong elbow. Oh, sure, in a general sense. But it does not prepare the athlete for throwing that particular pitch. The action has to be very specific. We have to maintain a particular angle. Well, we have to, you know, get strength at that angle and so on. So I hope that kind of answers your question now.
Absolutely. Now, I've even read and heard from various athletes who've gone through physical therapy, physical therapists, who blogs and stuff, they will talk about, they'll talk about the role of, or not specifically doing any kind of unilateral training during the rehabilitation process due to they are afraid of the other limb becoming too strong, during rehab. So when the athlete comes back, there's huge discrepancies. For example, an athlete comes off of ACL injury, they won't, the rehab specialist will not allow the athlete to do much strengthening of the opposite leg just because they don't want to create such an imbalance. I was curious to your thoughts if this holds water or if, again, they're just kind of misled here.
Well, it's a double-barreled question here, or, you know, a topic rather. There's no reason why you should eliminate or not use any unilateral. So what if the other leg is stronger? If you have a stronger leg, you know, just naturally. So by doing exercise, and there are two things involved here. If you do an exercise on one side of the body, there's some transfer to the other side. So if you exercise the good side, it'll help strengthen the weak side. So we do get some benefits from this. So if you did a unilateral exercise, you are going to get stronger on the opposite side. This is why, and this is a good doctor will tell you that, for example, if your leg is in a cast, you really can't exercise here, not even unilaterally, but to do isometrics. The more isometric you can do on a good leg, or even try doing it on the leg in a cast, you're going to start getting stronger. So we have to exercise both limbs. You don't want to just let that limb go and not do anything. Because then by the time the athlete, you know, is over with that injury on one side, he's going to be weak on both sides. It's going to take even longer to get back and get ready to play. Okay?
Yes, sir. And then I just want to kind of throw a scenario at you and kind of get your thoughts. Let's say it's in the middle of the season and an athlete gets hurt, goes through physical therapy, they become functional, you know, pain-free. They want to go through a return to play protocol. You're saying you would look at their mechanics first and foremost in order to spot the mechanism of injury. So let's say you look at their mechanics during the return to play protocol, you notice that their mechanics are all messed up and there's possibility of other injuries. Do you not allow that athlete to continue playing during the season because of the faulty mechanics and the possibility of further injuring themselves or re-injuring, or what during a season, what is your thoughts for that with athletes who are mechanically inefficient?
Well, if I had my brother, so to speak, I would not allow the athlete to play. But in today's culture, it's rare that this is going to happen. I've even had athletes the same way. You know, I tell them, well, I wouldn't play on it if I was you. Well, I have to, you know, I'm good for the team and all of this, you know, macho. Well, go ahead, but then you're looking at the possibility of getting another injury. So, I mean, your hands are tied. It's up to the athlete. You can only tell them what has to be. If I was working with a professional team, then I would say, don't allow that pitcher to pitch again until we make the corrections. And if they were smart, they would do it because they have a heck of a lot of money invested. So each situation is really going to have to be answered independently. There's no blanket statement that can be made here, Jeff.
Yes, sir.
I wish they were.
Okay. Now, I'm curious, too, if Igor or Yosef has any thoughts or questions.
I do, actually. When you mentioned the return to play, I have a sort of a hypothetical scenario. So let's say a thrower had back surgery in the lumbar section of the spine. Possible disc herniation is what we're talking about. And the doctor prescribed something along the lines of you're fine, you have gone through your physical therapy process, you've been cleared, you are pain-free, you may gradually return to normal practice. And they emphasize slow progressions on exercises, so slow progressions on squat, obviously no Olympic lifts, and slow progressions on bench press and everything else. If the athlete still has trouble with squat, or there might be, you know, a particular fear that one kind of squat is worse than the other, should the athlete focus on dynamic movement, something along the lines of a dumbbell jump, rather than squatting heavy? Basically what I'm asking is, would a dumbbell jump be slightly safer for somebody returning off of surgery, or would regular squatting with slow movement be safer?
Slow movements, squat. No jumping, because jumping puts a greater impact on the spine. But
okay.
Back up a little bit, Igor. I think you brought up a very good point here. You asked questions about the squat and other exercises after lumbar surgery or, you know, lumbar problem. But I didn't hear anything about strengthening the lumbar area. And the squat is not the way to strengthen the lumbar area. So we're exercising as the squat, as back raises. See, this is where the emphasis should be. We need more emphasis on exercise like the back raises. And then all the rotary exercises. See, now I don't know what kind of a throw you're talking about, and what is taking.
We would be talking about a shot putter. And let me clear something up. When you say back raises, is that the back raise done on the glute ham machine?
Correct.
Okay. What would be an alternative to the back raise if there wasn't a glucose machine nearby, and what if the doctor said to limit the twisting motions in the training process?
Well, then he's not ready to resume practice. See, but let's back up a little bit. You're bringing out some very important points here. You mentioned if they don't have a glued ham. Well, it's not just any glued ham. Most of the glued hams do not allow proper positioning to do the back raise. And most of your throwers, especially, like even your shot putters, they're fairly tall. And they are not going to fit the typical glued ham. So they have to get one similar to the one that I developed, the glued ham back machine. That's why I added the back to it, because we used it extensively to strengthen the lower back. And I think we did a clinic in Richmond. And I think, Jeff, you were there. Remember how we tried doing the back raise with many people and their glued hams weren't capable of doing it?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, see, they weren't able to do it. So, yeah, yes, you need a glued ham, and you can't do it on, there are other ways of doing it, but they get too complex and you need more people involved. So, then on the limiting the amount of rotation, this becomes critical. Do you do exercises, for example, as the reverse trunk twist? Not the Russian twist, because that's going to be too tough initially. But the reverse trunk twist and gradually developing a full range of motion and then finally going to the Russian twist. See, so if they can't get to those exercises or can't do those exercises successfully, I wouldn't be doing any throwing. Because then they're going to get injured again. Or the possibility of injury is going to be high.
Okay.
Now, I have another question. Let me back up again. I didn't interrupt you there. Also, well, we have to take a look at technique. Like you mentioned, the shot putter, does he rely on, let's say, the spin technique where rotation is big? Or is he more, not necessarily straight line, but where does he get most of his power from? From the legs or from the rotation or a combination of both?
See, it'd be a combination of the both.
Yeah. All right. See, then he's going to need an equal amount. But some just rely on the legs to get him up in the air and then release. Okay, so, see, that's another factor that comes in. What is he relying, what does he get most of his power from? So then maybe he can do exercise. If you have to limit the rotation, then we could do more throws, let's say from a stationary position, just from the legs. So we can work on the legs with limited rotation. Well, things like that. You probably already know. Okay, then go ahead and answer the other question.
The other question would be, you mentioned how in PT and rehab, many PTs are worried about strengthening one leg versus the other. And if we dwell upon it a little bit deeper into it, you said that one leg is naturally bigger. So should it be the goal to achieve balance in strength between the right quad and the left quad? Or should it be more of a goal to achieve a balance between the right quad and the right hamstring? Because those are their synchrony, to a certain extent, is more important in the short term for recovery, in my opinion, and correct me if I'm wrong, than it is the synchrony between the right quad and the left quad. Because if you have the synchrony between the quads, but not their synchrony with the hamstrings, you will eventually end up with a big pelvic tilt forward. Tell me if I'm right or wrong.
All right. If you already have if you're going to get a pelvic tilt, typically it's rare to see this. And even when we take a look at the balance or your balance between hamstrings and quads, well, it's only one of the quads. It's only the the rectus femoris. That's the only one that attaches onto the hip. So it's more the hip flexors that are involved, not the quads. If we're going to take a look at the full power of the quads, we have to take a look at knee flexion. See, then knee flexion is not that critical when it comes to the throws or, you know, balancing the muscles. And then just, so we haven't really looked at the same joint actions or analogous ones. Knee flexion, now we got to compare it to knee extension. Now let's compare the quads to the hamstrings. And then again, the ratios are off. Most people say it's got to be a one-on-one balance. No. Why? The quads are a heck of a lot bigger than the hamstrings. So typically, it's like a 3-to-1 ratio. Or maybe even a 4-to-1 ratio. So this is where it should be. But if we're going to compare the muscle action at the hip joint, see, then we're looking at something completely different. We can't use the balance at the knee joint as being the same as the hip joint. So, you know, it's always going to be quite a bit different. And then between the left and the right leg, it's not that important. I wouldn't spend a lot of time trying to get a balance. You got to strengthen both of them.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, I believe that kind of includes a lot of the questions that we had today. Jeff and Igor, both thanks for the questions. I think that gave a nice, broad perspective on some of these items, and thanks a lot, Doc, for answering them. Next week, what we're going to do, we'll come back, and Igor's going to ask some more questions as it relates to things in track and field, and throwing especially, and then, you know, some exercise-specific stuff. I think it's going to be very interesting, especially from a track coach's perspective. So this will definitely be something that I think will be interesting for a lot of people.
Yosef, I think we should bring out, even though it's track and field, for example, if it's the throws, it applies to all athletes that throw. Or if it's the jumps, it's all athletes who involve jumping in their sport. See, so even track and field is a wonderful sport, where training in track and field is analogous to training in just about all the other sports. One of the key elements. So it's really applicable to all coaches and sports, not just track and field.
Right. So we'll have a different perspective, and especially coming from the coach in the field. That's great. It keeps everything as relevant as possible. So we're looking forward to that next week. Thanks a lot, Jeff, especially for all the great questions and kind of taking over. And Igor, thanks for visiting with us today, and we look forward to having you on next week as well. And Doc, thanks as always, and we will talk to you guys next week.
Okay, very good.